Hi, welcome to Weekend Watchlist, a look at what's screening and streaming brought to you by The Letterboxd Show. I'm Mitchell, he's Slim.
Hello.
And together we'll dig through what's dropping this weekend, last weekend, recent trends on Letterboxd, and we'll also take a peek at our own watchlists.
We're back, baby! Mitchell, you've returned. You were on assignment last week. And can you confirm or deny the rumors that you needed a week off to prepare for the release of Morbius starring Jared Leto?
I'll say this, Slim. I think that, like most of the world, like it seems like all of the world, you know, based on the release strategy, I think I needed a couple years really to prepare for Morbius.
The first trailer, we'll get into it just in a minute, but the first trailer came out, what was it, January 2020 for Morbius?
Yeah, I have not gone to a movie theater since March 2020, and it is haunting to me that there's a movie coming out this weekend that I saw a trailer for multiple times in theaters.
So before we get into Morbius, this episode we're going to cover The Bubble, Apollo 10 and a half, and maybe even a little Memoria later in the show. So why not kick things off with our dear sweet boy, Morbius, directed by Daniel Espinosa. And this is on 30,000 watch lists, just in theaters. And this is as follows the synopsis: dangerously ill with a rare blood disorder and determined to save others from suffering his same fate, Dr. Michael Morbius attempts a desperate gamble. What at first appears to be a radical success soon reveals itself to be a remedy potentially worse than the disease. Mitch, are you familiar with Morbius in general before this movie had come about?
I don't think that I was. You know, when I was like a teenager, I was very much into comics. Spider-Man was definitely one of my main guys. But I, you know, when the trailer came out, when they were talking about the movie, I don't think that I was actually familiar with Morbius. I don't know if I just missed that or if he's one of kind of like the lower tier, you know, ones that isn't, mm-hmm. you know, the Vulture, Venom, Carnage, like the big ones. So yeah, Morbius, when I first heard about it, I was confused as to what this was and did not realize it for a little bit that they were, you know, doing the Sony finding other Spider-Man characters that they can do things with kind of thing. Is he, I know you're a comic guy. Is he somebody that you, you know, already were familiar with before hearing about the movie?
I am a comic dweeb. Growing up, he was like a B character, C character, aka the living vampire. Eventually, he did turn into like an anti-hero kind of deal where,
of course,
I think he only would drink the blood of the guilty.
Oh, a little Dexter going on.
The original Dexter, Morbius. But yeah, again, when this had been announced, it just felt like Sony was kind of like grasping at Spidey straws in terms of characters. With that said, Venom seems to be pretty popular with a select group of movie fans. So yeah, maybe there's something here for Morbius. I don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's a weird movie to talk about because obviously for years now, it's kind of gotten memed to, you know, into oblivion a little bit on Twitter and everywhere that, you know, it's kind of a joke of a movie. They, you know, push the release date back many times. It's now coming out on April 1st, which seems a little bit like almost tongue in cheek that they pushed it back again to April 1st. But at the same time, and I can't say I'm necessarily looking forward to seeing it. But at the same time, you know, Venom had a lot of kind of negative buzz going into it as well. And it's gotten, you know, both of the Venom movies have not gotten the best critical reception, but they're the people who ride for it, really ride for it. So, you know, there's definitely a potential that Morbius could get a similar kind of, you know, mini kind of cult following.
We'll find out next week. We'll see what the Letterboxd community thinks about Morbius.
We certainly will. And also coming out this week, we'll move into The Bubble, the latest from Judd Apatow. This is coming out on Netflix and in theaters. It's on 4,000 watch lists right now, a little bit low for a Judd Apatow movie. The synopsis of it: sneaking out, hooking up, melting down. The cast and crew of a blockbuster action franchise attempt to shoot a sequel while quarantining at a posh hotel. You know, the buzz on it is not, there's not a lot going on, which is really interesting to me. I mean, part of that comes from, you know, the Netflix release strategy. It's kind of a little bit kind of being siloed into the Netflix bubble, if you will. But you know, Judd Apatow for me was a really formative kind of guy. When I was a teenager, I discovered Freaks and Geeks and Undeclared, which were both really kind of like foundational touchstones for me that I still love. And then in the mid-2000s, he started directing his own features with 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up. And I feel like it's kind of this interesting trajectory with the name Judd Apatow, where there was that period of time for like 8 years in the like mid to late 2000s where his name was really synonymous with what studio comedy was. And like everybody knew the name Judd Apatow. But now, even in just such like a short period of time, there's a whole generation of people who know him as the director dad, whose name they don't know, but they know him as like the nepotism fueling father of Euphoria's playwright queen Lexi, aka Maude Apatow, his daughter. And it's just so interesting how like the trajectory, I think it says a lot too about, you know, obviously studio comedies, that his name has just gone from being this like huge powerhouse to now being what it is, where this whole generation of people don't even know who he is. They're just like, oh yeah, that's Lexi's dad. That's so weird.
Yeah.
You know, how is Judd Apatow for you? What do you think of when you think of Judd Apatow?
The Larry Sanders Show on HBO was and is huge for me. It's one of my favorite all-time television shows. And you were right. 40-Year-Old Virgin had come out. And man, remember when every studio comedy had like that poster style for years?
Yeah.
Of like the bright colors in the background and the character's face? I mean, it feels so long ago, but that was such a huge era. You're right. A period of 8 years where Judd Apatow was like leading the charge in a lot of these studio movies. And I guess you could say the same thing about Adam McKay too.
Yeah, like for
they
sure.
They were both kind of reinventing that studio comedy. And the cast for this movie is gigantic. Karen Gillan, Brent Armisen, David Duchovny is in this. Kate McKinnon, Pedro Pascal. So it's a giant cast. And actually, well, I think we did both watch. We're under strict embargo.
Very strict embargo.
We can't even give our opinion on it. But it is very much in the mode of like a COVID film. You know, that's the gist of it. They poke fun at that. They're filming a COVID movie. They're under quarantine. And it's the kind of tribulations that go along with it. So I think Judd has done a lot of documentaries over the last couple of years, or that's the main work that Judd had done. So this is kind of like a return.
Yeah. And it's interesting that it is not getting kind of, you know, that much attention. But at the same time, as we are under embargo, you know, you can say that a movie not lifting its embargo until 6 hours before it comes out on Netflix for everybody to see, maybe says something about the movie itself and how good it may or may not be. I don't know. I can't say.
The Netflix lawyer in our recording studio just gave the cutoff motion. They're giving the cutoff to Mitchell. We can no longer make any.
I can't say. I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying when the embargo lifts. That's all I'm saying.
So that's on Netflix and theaters. Next on our list, Letterboxd Darling. Richard Linklater makes their first appearance on Weekend Watchlist with a new movie also hitting Netflix this weekend. 6,300 watchlists, Apollo 10.5, A Space Age Childhood. A man narrates stories of his life as a 10-year-old boy in 1969, Houston, weaving tales of nostalgia with a fantastical account of a journey to the moon. This is narrated by Jack Black. What's Jiblin Jables? Famous YouTuber nowadays. Maybe people only know Jack Black from his YouTube channel, which
I was very surprised when I found out that he has a YouTube channel and is also like very into it. He's very much like a YouTuber. Yeah. It has like a big following and everything.
You have some thoughts on this movie. You've watched this.
Yeah. We both got the chance to check this out. We are able to talk about this one.
the lawyer has left the studio. They've gone back to the legal offices.
The sniper rifle has moved off of me and onto my cat for some reason. I don't know what's going on there, but hopefully that'll turn out all right. I definitely liked the movie. It's a very interesting, you know, it's using the kind of rotoscope animation technique that Linklater's films used with Waking Life and A Scanner Darkly before, which I really love. Scanner Darkly in particular is one of my favorite Linklater movies. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, a fascinating animation style, but it's different than those movies in the sense that, you know, those are a little bit more fantastical. Scanner Darkly very much is like a dystopian sci-fi almost. And this one is kind of the Linklater that people are more familiar with or maybe associate him with more, kind of those reflective looks back on like memory and time. You know, people know him from the the Before, Sunrise, Sunset, Midnight trilogy, Boyhood, Dazed and Confused, movies that really just analyze these kind of periods of life where we're coming of age. And the whole moon odyssey kind of element into it is interesting. I like the NASA angle that the film opens up on and eventually, like, a long time later returns to. But a lot of the movie really is Jack Black as kind of the older version of this main character narrating just kind of the minutia, like, day-to-day moments of his life. And I found a lot to relate to in how it captures kind of the fantastical stories that we would make up for ourselves as a kid, along with, even though the movie takes place in 1969, like, I grew up a couple decades after that, it really speaks to how much we were able to get away with when, you know, we were kids. I think that there's so much stuff in this movie, and then in, like, my own childhood, I don't know if it's the same for you, where you look back and you're like, I should have died. Like, there are very dangerous things that I was doing every day and just getting away with.
My favorite parts of the movie were those exact moments of him retelling the story of them in the back of a pickup truck about how, like, one false move and all the kids would have been dead, but it's something that wasn't talked about or thought of.
Shooting roaming candles at each other with, like, trash cans as, like, your trash can lids as your defense.
Yeah, I would have loved a 2-hour movie just of that, of those stories of the childhood. So I think we're in agreement that those were, you know, my favorite parts of the film. And do we have a clip? Do we have a clip to play, Mitchell?
I think we've got a clip. You know, the film premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival recently before, you know, coming to Netflix. And we had Annie Lyons, our correspondent down in Austin, was on the red carpet at the premiere and was able to get a few minutes with Linklater talking about exactly these kind of things that we're talking about, you know, memory and nostalgia and all of that. And I think we might very much have a clip here to play of Linklater talking about this at South by Southwest.
Roll the clip, please.
Roll it.
You know, it's funny. One of the great things about getting older is you get to, like, have this relationship to your past. And I think cultures do that. Individuals do that. And, you know, it's a really kind of interesting space to operate in. And I wanted to do this film both personally, obviously, but then, you know, there's a bigger cultural analysis to just everything from, like, parenting. You know, people parented different back then. The culture was very different. So, I don't know. Nostalgia is kind of a double-edged sword. You know, it's kind of, not necessarily positive, but, you know. I think we all want to look back and understand stuff that we maybe didn't understand at the time.
I think he's right about the nostalgia being a double-edged sword. But for me, that was those were my favorite parts of the movie. And we do have a review from Matt Herrero, who was at South by Southwest for the whole deal. And they tagged their review weekend watch list. So if you want your review spotlighted potentially on the show, be sure to tag your reviews weekend watch list. Using significantly more advanced animation techniques that go far beyond the rotoscope work his team pioneered on Waking Life and A Scanner Darkly, Linklater creates a transcendent celebration of those heady final days of that defining decade. What's your favorite Linklater movie?
I think my favorite, probably, you know, speaking of Jack Black, I really love School of Rock. And, you know, Scanner Darkly, I think Scanner Darkly and School of Rock are probably my two faves. I always kind of forget that Linklater did School of Rock. And then I remember and I'm like, oh yeah, what a movie. That movie holds up. Those songs, I was thinking about after watching Apollo 10 and a half, I was thinking about School of Rock and I was found myself singing the songs to School of Rock in the shower that next morning. And I know all the words still to the School of Rock soundtrack. I know you're a School of Rock guy, right?
Huge fan. That might be a perfect movie. I think we watched that with my son, James, for the first time. And at the end of the movie, he's like, I think this might be the greatest movie I've ever seen.
It might be
and I've only seen Before Sunrise a couple weeks ago for the first time.
Right, for the Letterboxd show. Right? Cover that one?
That was for the Letterboxd show with Gemma. And those are, you know, that's what I consider like a quote Letterboxd movie. It's, you know, that's like in the community. So I finally was able to check that off. I did enjoy it. And I'm excited to go through the rest of the trilogy.
Slim, we've looked at the movies that are coming out this weekend. I think now it's time for us to look back, to last week's movies to see what the Letterboxd community is saying. And remember, for listeners, if you want your review or list potentially featured on an upcoming episode of Weekend Watchlist, just add the tag #WeekendWatchlist.
I mean, you want to talk about buzz. The nuclear buzz around Daniel's Everything Everywhere All at Once. It's chilling at a 4.6 average on Letterboxd. And we'll go deeper into more data and stats in just a few minutes. But we also added an Easter egg. We're not going to tell you what it is right now, but we added that Easter egg. And I know you're not going to theaters right now, hopefully in the future. But what's your idea on this movie? I mean, it's nuclear buzz.
Yeah, nuclear, definitely the word. I feel like we haven't seen a buzz on a movie like this, probably on Letterboxd, since Parasite. Is really the last time that I can think of a movie just surging the way that this one is. People are just really loving it. You know, you and Mia both had seen it, talked about it, how much you both loved it on last week's episode. We've got plenty of very euphoric reviews coming in on Letterboxd for the film. I wanted to highlight one of them, though. I wanted to highlight David Chen, host of the Filmcast, somebody that we all love very much. You know, his review of the film on Letterboxd, he said, "Once every few years, a film comes along that is so audacious, funny, original, technically dazzling, and thematically resonant, we feel blessed to have been alive to see it. This is such a film. It spoke to me on such a core level that it felt genetically engineered to meet me at this point in my life. It may be my new favorite movie of all time. No joke." That's huge praise. That's somebody who sees many, 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 many movies and is really considering it being his favorite movie of all time.
We were talking about in the Letterboxd crew's Slack, you know, it hasn't opened wide yet. And I was kind of wondering, like, man, I wonder what the discourse is going to be when everyone can see this. Because it's so, you know, me, we talked about before about my reverse hype. Like when the hype gets too hot, I start to get like anti that movie. So I do worry that hopefully that doesn't happen for this movie, because it was a lot of fun. And it's a really dynamic science fiction movie. I said it was just so frenetically paced. I couldn't remember a movie that made me feel that way. It was, I think I said it was like an Edgar Wright movie.
Yeah, you related to Scott Pilgrim specifically.
Yeah, remember how Scott Pilgrim made you feel in theaters? It was similar to that. I mean, it's up there. We'll reveal some stats that might shock you to your core later in this episode.
First, before we do that, though, the other film that is currently already wide in theaters playing right now that came out last week is The Lost City with Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum. You and Mia talked about it last week, but let's give a look at some of the Letterboxd reviews that have come in for The Lost City. One that I wanted to highlight from Jay Ledbetter about The Lost City. He says, "I'm not saying this is some sort of return to a bygone era, but movie stars, locations, it actually looks expensive. Just a hell of a time at the movies. The batting average on the jokes isn't super high, but The Lost City made me yearn for above average studio comedies. I am absolutely in for returns to stardom for both Channing and Sandy."
Sandy, the return of Sandy.
Oh, I miss her so much.
Kev tagged their review, Weekend Watch List. "So this is what truly entertained feels like. The Lost City is everything Hollywood should be making, a wildly silly movie that earns its gooey sentimentality through the winning charisma of the stars and doesn't exist to sell you anything, but more of the same. And I want more now."
Holy smokes. Speaking of wanting more now, I did see a few reviews on Letterboxd that mentioned a particular scene in The Lost City where apparently leeches suck out Channing Tatum's butt. So if that's, you know, if that's something that you're interested in, which I think that we all probably are, you know, get out there and see The Lost City.
Oh my God. So what did you want to spotlight as well for this previous week and maybe upcoming?
Yeah, one thing I wanted to spotlight is Memoria, the film from the director Apichapong Weerasethakon, which a lot of people have not been able to see yet. It's finally, you know, its release strategy has been very fascinating, very confusing. Yeah. For many months, people weren't sure when it was going to come out. Neon's strategy was allegedly having this kind of roadshow thing where it was going to play in one theater at a time forever in perpetuity. But they finally released a calendar of when it's coming out. It seems like it's having maybe a little bit more. It'll probably always be only in theaters still. Maybe it won't come out to streaming and physical media, but which is definitely very exciting for people who have been, you know, yearning to see the film and not even known when they might have the chance to. I thankfully got to see it last year, and it was one of my favorite films of 2021. I remember coming on the Letterboxd show with you and Gemma at the end of the year. We had me and Aaron Yap come on to talk about our favorite films of 2021. And on that episode, I described it as the kind of film that makes you totally rethink and reflect on your relationship with the universe, with other people, and with yourself, which I still stand by that statement. For people who don't know what the film is about, it's kind of a simple premise. Tilda Swinton plays a Scottish orchard farmer who's living in Colombia, and she starts to hear this increasingly loud bang. She wakes up one morning just hearing this bang, and she, you know, she keeps hearing it louder and louder, kind of slowly, randomly throughout, and it's terrifying her. It's apparently a real, you know, syndrome. I think it called it exploding head syndrome, that the director had an experience with as well. And it's used as kind of a way for her to start exploring what the sound is and figuring out kind of the mystery of it. But that is not exactly what the movie is about. It's kind of hard to describe. It's, you know, if you've seen his films, it's very reflective. It's very contemplative. It definitely gets into these like meditative ideas of what your place is in the universe. Mm-hmm. I myself would definitely describe me as a slut for slow cinema. And that's definitely what this is. If you like his movies, you would very much like this one. If you haven't seen his films, check it out. You know, and I interviewed him last year for Letterboxd Journal, which I encourage everyone to read that interview if, you know, you sound like, if it sounds like you might be interested in it. But more importantly, for people who are interested and want to see the film, you can finally see the schedule of where and when it's going to be playing at the URL memoria.film/locations. That's Memoria spelled memoria.film/locations to see where and when it's going to be playing and if you might be able to see it.
Yeah, we'll have a link in the episode notes as well. I'll just, the last thing on Memoria, I'll read your first sentence of your 5-star review.
5 stars.
As a certified slow cinema bitch, this was my ideal Thanksgiving viewing. What I also love about this is, I think right before this, you had watched Last Night in Soho. So what a twofer.
Yeah, in terms of
running the gamut of your rating scale.
Yeah, not as big on Last Night in Soho.
All right, so now we're at the final portion of our episode where we'll look at Jack's top 50 of 2022. He updates it weekly, and these are the trending movies. So you get a real indication of where films are slotting on the list. And we talked about it briefly, Everything Everywhere All at Once isn't eligible for the all-time 250 just yet because it didn't hit 5,000 ratings by the time Monday. But we can say that right now it's fitting between Come and See and Harakiri, which would make it our all-time number 3 movie, Mitchell.
Yeah, if you want to talk about nuclear buzz, that's all-time number 3 on Letterboxd. You can't get much more nuclear than that.
Don't let everyone's maybe getting slimfluence, as I call it. You know, the hype,
yeah,
the reverse
careful.
Hype might be setting it. Everyone just stay calm. Try not to read anything. Just go in. Totally behind
don't,
and make
yeah,
your own
don't,
decisions.
Don't go in thinking this is going to be the 3rd best movie of all time. Just go in, you know, with as clean a slate as you possibly yes. can and just let it wash over you. Don't go in meaning like go in with this kind of demanding, you better be as good as everybody's saying you're going to be. Don't be a slim, basically.
Don't be a slim. Can we get that on the Letterboxd storefront?
That's the tagline for Weekend Watchlist. Don't be a slim. Here's what's coming out this week. Don't be a slim.
What else should we talk about from Jack's list for this week?
Jack wanted to highlight in terms of the top 50 of 2022, there's a lot of world cinema going on. A big call out this week is a film called RRR, which stands for Rise, Roar, Revolt. It's a 3-hour Indian action historical epic about two 1920s revolutionaries. This one is entering into the top 50 at number 17, which is pretty high. I've been seeing a lot of buzz for this on Twitter. You know, we tweeted out a clip of it on our Twitter, and immediately the tweets, the engagement were just off the chart for it. So it's got a big following going on. I think Jack mentioned that it got presented as an event release In the U.S. as of Friday in 1,200 theaters with, it's got an intermission and a pricier ticket, and it made nearly $10 million in the U.S. over the weekend. So there's definitely a audience coming in for this, and we're seeing that audience showing up on Letterboxd and giving it very high praise.
I came out of trailer retirement, and I did watch the clip from this movie. And it is insane.
Yeah, I've got friends who are very big action fans like yourself, and ones who have seen it and are very definitely like all about it. So if you're a big action fan who feels like maybe, you know, Netflix movies and big Hollywood blockbusters have been letting you down a little bit in their CGI heavy approach to action, maybe this is one to check out for you and see some of the cool stuff that's going on in other areas of action cinema.
I tweeted about your return to the pod earlier today, and Kin's Film on Twitter replied and said, every time It's Mitchell is on the pod, I always end up finishing that episode with 20 new movies added to my watch list. So this section of the show, maybe we'll shuffle our watch list for the first time with Mitchell.
Let's do it.
And we'll see what we have to watch before we meet next on this podcast. Mia and I did it a few weeks ago. I ended up with Wolf Guy. She ended up with Scanners. She sounds pretty trepidatious about finally watching Scanners.
A little bit. She was psyching herself up for it. I will watch Scanners. I will do it.
It did not sound like it was going to happen. So if you want to join us, you can head to your watch list on Letterboxd, and you can, so we'll do it by streaming our streaming services. So filter your service by stream only and then sort by shuffle. So we will see what's next on our list. I'm going to do it right now. I'm hitting shuffle. Dress to Kill by Brian De Palma, streaming on HBO Max. That is my next film. Look at that poster. Mamma Mia. Have you seen? I'm looking to see if there's a review from you on here. I'm not finding it just yet. Have you seen Brian De Palma's Dress to Kill?
I have seen it. So when I saw it, I was not super familiar, especially with Brian De Palma's earlier stuff. So when I saw it, I was a little taken aback by maybe there are some questionably problematic elements of the film, which is water that I have now learned you kind of can expect with Brian De Palma, especially his earlier stuff. So I think when I went into it, I was a little bit shocked and not sure what to expect by it. So I wasn't a big fan of it when I saw it, but it is one that I've been wanting to revisit because since that time, I've become a huge fan of Brian De Palma. I love Blowout. I recently, last year, saw Body Double for the first time, which is now one of my favorite films. So I want to check out Dress to Kill, give it a rewatch. Maybe I'll rewatch it before you and I are back on here so we can discuss it together a little bit.
Yes. All right. So what is your result from you shuffling your watch list on streaming services only?
My result is a film from one of my favorite directors, John Carpenter, that I have not seen. It is called Ghosts of Mars.
Oh, baby.
It is streaming on Hulu. It has a 2.3 average rating on Letterboxd. The only thing I really knew about the film was that it was directed by John Carpenter. It was not one of his particularly well-received films. And that among its cast is Pam Grier, who, you know, we all love very much. So I am going to excitedly, with a very open mind, get into Ghosts of Mars. Is that one that you have seen from the Carpenter
I have
oeuvre?
Not seen Ghosts of Mars. 2001, the tagline, terror is the same on any planet.
It's the same on any planet.
You almost sound like Mia now. You're getting yourself psyched up to see
Ghosts of Mars. I'm excited. Melanie Ballard is a hard-nosed police chief in the year 2025, the very distant future, as we all know. I'm very excited to see what's going on Mars and what those ghosts are up to.
Thanks so much for listening to Weekend Watchlist, brought to you by The Letterboxd Show. You can follow Mitchell, Slim, that's me, and our HQ page on Letterboxd using the links in our episode notes.
Thanks to our crew, and thanks to Letterboxd member Trent Wallen for the theme music Eyes On. We want to give a thanks to Jack for the facts and Sophie Shin for the episode transcript. And most of all, thanks to all of you for listening. Weekend Watchlist is a Tape Deck production.
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.